This is the Edisto TV podcast, connecting the Blackwater region.
Welcome to episode 12 of the Edisto TV podcast. I'm Hugo.
And I'm Tom.
And we are here again with more from our interview we did a week or so ago with Bill Marshall of the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources. And in this episode, we're going to get down to the nitty-gritty of some of the issues that are involved in the existing Surface Water Withdrawal Act here in South Carolina, and also some of the sort of larger philosophical underpinnings of the question of whether or not this is something that we can or should do anything about. As we talk about that from that perspective, we also have been posting a lot of content from off the internet having to do with water withdrawal, water quality, water quantity issues. And Tom, what have we been seeing online lately?
Well, there's several articles that were posted up on Edisto Concerns that people kind of took notice of. One was in the New York Times, which was specifically talking about these threats to our drinking water, and kind of related to that one was the Lake Erie toxic bloom. So that we had two different articles related to that. But basically, they've shut down drinking water in Toledo, I believe it is.
They shut it down for a while. They actually are now letting them use their drinking water again, and they say everything's all right.
Yeah, and the thing that really hits home is that the people are blaming it on farmers, saying that the reason is because they're, you know, all this runoff from the farms is washing into the lake, and then that's, you know, causing these things. And of course, Farm Bureau has come to their defense and said, no, it's not the farmers. And so it's an interesting discussion. I don't think they've reached a clear conclusion on the cause of these things, but it's a problem.
Yeah, and I think, as always, there are people on either extreme, and the answer probably lies somewhere in the middle. Quick excerpt from that New York Times Threats to Our Drinking Water article, and I'm quoting from them there. This moment also calls for a change in thinking about how we can best achieve our nation's clean water goals. Traditionally, water policy has dealt with issues of quality and quantity separately. This approach must be replaced by an integrated strategy that addresses both together. Neither plentiful, polluted water nor scarce, clean water will meet our needs.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because, you know, it's great to have a lot of water, but if you can't drink it, it's probably not really that valuable.
Yeah, and it all brings it back home also to the sort of issues we've been dealing with right here in the Edisto watershed as well. Moving on, talking about this toxic bloom that has been blamed on farmers and Farm Bureau coming to their defense and that part of it, you know, it really highlights the way that these issues polarize opinion. There are the extremes obscuring the broad continuum of middle ground where the problems, interests, and solutions may all find something in common that can bring people together who seemingly are on other sides of this issue. You know, I always return to the conversation that developed between Friends of the Edisto and the Walther brothers here on the South Fork of the Edisto, that when we actually started talking to each other, we were able to find some potential solutions to pursue. And, you know, if all you do is stand on either side of your barricades and yell and throw stuff, you're never going to accomplish anything.
Right. And, you know, in South Carolina right now, when it comes to changing the water law, it seems to be mostly it's the Farm Bureau that at this point has dug in their heels and is saying that, you know, they don't want to change to the water laws. And I think that, you know, right now the folks at Farm Bureau are making the rounds and trying to do what they call their policy discussions with their members. And we need to try to help change their mind. And that means people who are in any way affiliated with Farm Bureau need to show up at these meetings and let Farm Bureau know that we need to change these laws. They're not fair to farmers. They're not fair to citizens. They're not fair to any users of these river. And it needs to change. It needs to change this year, in this next session.
And I believe we're going to have some information in the show notes if people want to follow up on that Farm Bureau policy creation process. Especially if you're a member of the Farm Bureau, this is an opportunity for you to let your organization know how you feel about these issues. Also, one of the New York Times articles that we posted on Edisto Concerns this week, having to do with development in the Grand Canyon. There are a couple of different projects that that article talks about. But again, a quote from that New York Times article about the Grand Canyon development issues also came right back home for me to this one. That one, they said, quote, "Conservationists often lament the inherent unfairness of fights like this. Whenever a developer is defeated, nothing prevents other developers from stepping forward again and again. But for those who love wilderness, the loss of a single battle can mean the end of the war, because landscapes that fall to development will never return."
Yeah, and the Grand Canyon, I like your comment in that post was, you know, hey, it's the Grand Canyon. I mean, yeah. can we not protect the Grand Canyon? I mean, but hey, the Edisto River Basin and, you know, the land surrounding it is still one of the most wild places anywhere, certainly on the East Coast and in the Southeast. But it can be threatened. I mean, it only takes one guy to come in and want to put an amusement park on their edge of the river. And we need to be guarding against that. I don't think that's what we want for the Edisto.
I agree. And, you know, I was really struck by, as we began to get involved in the Edisto River's protection over the past months or years, you always hear people say, well, you know, nothing can touch the Edisto. It's you know, practically sacred. Nobody's going to do anything to it. But we have learned that that is not necessarily the case. And, you know, you see that even the Grand Canyon is subject to the same pressures that our little Blackwater River is subject to. So, you know, we've got to stand up for what we believe and what we want to protect.
I think it was the park ranger or superintendent or whatever it was, but he was saying that, you know, most of his time is defending against threats like that. And so I'm starting to feel like what we're doing here may be a long-term commitment from a group of motivated citizens to protect this river, because I think it's going to be threatened on an ongoing basis going forward.
And actually, there is a thread of a topic there that I think we're going to pick up in future episodes of the Edisto TV podcast, because I get a lot of, not really pushback, but conversation with people who say, well, you know, you're so worried about the Edisto, why aren't you worried about this and that and the other? And, you know, basically, I have made a decision that I want to do something about the Edisto. And I'm concerned about everything else in the world that deserves to be concerned about, but this is where I've chosen to concentrate my efforts.
Right, but one thing interesting is these laws that affect the Edisto that we spend so much time talking about, they affect every river system in the state. And so one of the things we need to try to do, and we need help from everybody out there on Facebook and on the web and anybody listening, but we need to get people involved that are involved with these other systems. So we need people on the PD, we need people on the Salkehatchee, we need people on every river system in this state to see the threat the way we got to see it firsthand.
Absolutely. And we are looking for ways of making common cause. And because of that, we're, you know, reaching out to traditional old line organizations like Sierra Club and South Carolina Conservation Voters and South Carolina Wildlife Federation, Coastal Conservation League. All of these groups are coming together and finding common ground for what they care about. The river keepers from various South Carolina rivers, I know, are also involved. So we are making common cause, but, you know, I can't fix the world. I might be able to do something for the Edisto, and that's where my head is at these days.
That's right.
All right. So with that as preamble, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with the second part of the interview we did with Bill Marshall a few days ago. This is the Edisto TV Podcast.
Hey, this is Tom from Edisto TV, welcoming our new sponsor, the Black River Chop House in Orangeburg, recently voted by the Times and Democrat as the best place for a cocktail, best place for nightlife. Check out the team over there at the Black River Chop House in Orangeburg Mall. Great place to go when you're thirsty, great place to go with some old friends, or go meet some new ones. Black River Chop House, quality food and spirits in the heart of Orangeburg.
So last week here on the Edisto TV podcast, we did the first half of our interview that we did with Bill Marshall, and he introduced himself, talked about who he was and how he got involved with the Edisto River, in general and how that fits in with his job with the Department of Natural Resources and his role at the Friends of the Edisto organization. This week, we're going to go into a lot more specifics about what's up with the existing statute and how there might be some things that we could do to make that statute work better and more as intended. And also, in general, we talk a little bit with Bill about whether or not there really is an issue that needs to be addressed with this law, and in general, whether there is urgency in the struggle that we're engaged in. So we'll get to all that, and we're going to start right now with a question that Tom had for Bill Marshall.
While the Surface Water Removal Act is our number one priority, you know, we got to get our arms around groundwater. As these farms grow dry out west, you know, these people are naturally looking for water sources. And if it means digging 400 feet down or whatever it is here, or taking it from the river, you know, I would imagine over the next 50 years, they're going to be looking hard at places like us that have plentiful supply of water.
Sometimes when we talk about the groundwater, the wells having an effect on groundwater, that can be discounted by some who say, well, I've got to, I'm not having an effect. They're saying, I have a deep well. It goes to the deep aquifer. And the rationale there is this idea that you're a deep layer. The layer you're pulling water from is separated from the surface aquifer that provides most of the recharge to your river. There's this idea, this concept of a confining bed, and that's typically like a impermeable clay layer that separates maybe a sandy, gravelly kind of layer below it that's rich in water. It confines it to at depth, and so that water is inhibited from coming to the surface. And so a well user might say, I'm drawing from deep, and so I'm pulling from water that's not affecting your river. But there's, you know, we're all limited in our knowledge, and so there's some recharge from those deep aquifers that gets to streams, most likely. That's probably documented in ways that I'm unaware of. But yeah, there's definitely a connection. And water resources are important. They need to be managed well, and we need more information. We're ultimately going to have more rules to guide how we manage, how we use these resources and help us better manage them.
With that as sort of preamble, can you go through the last few, like six or seven slides of the PowerPoint, where you're talking about what the perceived weaknesses in the existing law are and what the remedies might be?
So we got the South Carolina Surface Water Permitting Act. That's my short title. We know that generally that law requires consumptive water users to be subject to a permit application and evaluation by DHEC. It has conditions on use of water, and there are some public notice requirements. But then there's a whole host of users of water, and as everybody who was using water prior to the act being passed who are grandfathered. So much of the act and its requirements apply to new water users. So that's something to understand. And I say that in terms in the context of protecting minimum flows and streams and other requirements that might encourage water conservation. Those sorts of things don't apply to existing users is the way I read the act. And I might oversimplify or overlook some things as I talk about this, because I'm a fairly new student to this statute myself. A number of people in the DNR were involved with the legislative process years ago, you know, when the statute was being developed, and I was not one of those people. I became more knowledgeable of the statute when it started affecting the Edisto. There's this concern that agriculture has very little requirement under the act. You know, they're not a, they're not subject to most requirements of the Act. They don't have to demonstrate reasonableness of use. They don't have to have supplemental sources of water. They're not required to curtail or stop withdrawals of water to protect minimum in stream flows. That's easy for you to say. Minimum in stream flows. And so there's been a lot of talk about what needs to happen with agriculture. And one of the ideas is to just simply require agricultural users to get a permit from DHEC. And just like all other consumptive water users, you could require agricultural users to go under the permitting process for surface water removals at DHEC. And, you know, there's concern for the small farmer wanting to guard them from regulatory burdens. So some sort of threshold for small water users could be identified where you wouldn't overly burden the small farmer with having to go into the permitting process, but you would capture those that are larger withdrawals. So that's one approach to deal with the agricultural issue. Our staff here have had a lot of heartburn about this concept of safe yield is defined in the statute, and it doesn't make much sense to us. And we think there was probably an intention or an understanding of what it might be, but maybe there was some oversights of what it really is, because it doesn't make a lot of sense. But the concept of safe yield, as it's defined in the Act, is just not sustainable. Safe yield is a term that defines how much water can be allocated to surface water withdrawal. So it's sort of defining how much water you can take out of the stream. And as it stands, it's defined as 80% of the mean annual daily flow is what's considered safe yield, and that's a lot of water to be taken out of a stream or to be allocated to off-stream uses to be pumped out and used elsewhere. And we think the safe yield will over-allocate the water. It'll ultimately lead to conflicts among the users, and it will degrade streams. If you were to allocate all 80% of the mean annual daily flow, it's just not sustainable. It's just not there about 50% of the time or more. Particularly the low summer flow months, the fall season and the summer season, we have low water in South Carolina. And safe yield's not there. 80% of mean annual daily flow is typically not there in the summer and the fall. And if you're giving all that away to water users, then you don't have a stream left. The other big concern is just the provision, protection, acknowledgement of the importance of minimum in-stream flows in that statute. There is a definition of minimum in-stream flows. It's a term in the law that typically you can think of it as being a trigger on limits or trigger that limits the withdrawals to protect stream health and downstream users. There would be a point in which a level at which you would want to start to curtail, conserve, and find alternative source of water if you were a surface water withdrawer. And there's different methods and procedures, sort of desktop approaches. They're in the field measures or techniques for defining what a minimum in-stream flow ought to be. The statute defines one that's based on statistics, a seasonally adjusted percentage of mean annual daily flow, and that standard works for a lot of streams. It doesn't fit very well for the Edisto. We think it's a standard that's too low for the Edisto. This is 20, 30, 40% of mean annual daily flow, which is a seasonally adjusted flow. So in the winter and early spring, you'd have 40%. You'd want 40% of mean annual daily flow, and in the summer and the fall, you'd want 20% of mean annual daily flow. And then there's some interim periods, late spring or maybe in December, you might want 30% of mean annual daily flow. And that works well in a lot of streams, but it doesn't work very well in the Edisto. So we think minimum in-stream flows as a, from a policy matter, needs to be something that's strengthened, better acknowledged and protected through the statute and the regs. And so there probably needs to be more flexibility in defining what a minimum in-stream flow standard ought to be. And one of the bigger concern, or big concern, is that we have grandfathered users. There's, you know, only new permittees under the statute are required to, are subject to a minimum flow requirement. So everybody else, all the rest of us, have been using waters from day one. We're not subject to minimum in-stream flow standards. And that's something that we're going to have to come to grips with at some point down the line, because as we continue to grow, we have got to have some policies in the state that are going to commit us to conserving water and protecting in-stream flows for our streams, for the sake of our streams and for the sake of downstream users. It's a concept that supports the sharing of the resource and protection of the resource. So we got to do better with a minimum in-stream flow policy for the state of South Carolina. So those are the big issues from our perspective, I think, from the DNR perspective. I'm not speaking for the DNR. I don't think our board, and I know our board hasn't come out and said anything specifically about these issues, but the leadership among staff, we were involved with the legislative process years ago, and we definitely have been sharing our perspectives internally about, what the deficiencies are and what ultimately is going to be needed to better manage stream resources in the future. The connection with groundwater that you asked about, we know, base flow, the concept of base flow in streams, that's the flow you see in a river or stream after, after the surface runoff has stopped. When it rains, you get surface flows of water that you see running down the street or across the field, across your yard, and that's surface water or surface runoff. When all that stuff goes away, when it hadn't rained for a while, you don't see any more of that. What's continuing to feed the streams is essentially groundwater. It's in most of the flow you'll see comes from what you might call surface water aquifer, or the water that's immediately encountered when you drill a well, the water table. So the surface of the earth takes in water. That's the surface aquifer. That surface groundwater, the groundwater that's closest to the surface of the earth, that's probably your primary source of recharge of these streams. It's probably the primary source for base flow. That's the flow that we see there in dry times. And then the more mysterious part would be flows that come from even deeper. And that is probably an understanding that we don't have a very good handle on. I mean, we don't have a good handle on how deep aquifers might be feeding streams. But groundwater is essential for sustaining streams. And if you were to have wells where you had a lot of heavy pumping of that surface aquifer, you could turn the flow away from your stream, so your groundwater is no longer in a certain location where you might have a heavy, a large well withdrawing surface from the surface aquifer. You could have the reversal of flow. It's no longer flowing to your stream, but it's flowing to the well and out through a pump, and either providing water for water, supplying water for some use. So groundwater definitely supports surface water, and to some degree, you'll find the surface, the streams in a river, in some cases, will recharge the groundwater. So you, in some places, we have losing streams, or something that's sometimes called, and that's where water is going from the surface stream into the ground, and actually recharging groundwater. So that happens in some cases. And the Edisto is thought to be that way, but I don't know if it's fully understood at all. But we know that we've seen in through long-term data that there's less water at one point on the stream than there is at an upstream point. And taking into account all that we know about withdrawals and water uses, there seems to be a loss of water to the aquifer. You know, so it's maybe a natural losing stream.
We'll be back with more of our interview with Bill Marshall in just a moment right here on the Edisto TV podcast.
Hey, this is Tom from Edisto TV letting you know a couple big things going on at Tyler Brothers. First of all, it's the end of summer clearance sale, so if it's a short sleeve, it's on sale. We've got savings up to 60% on various Carhartt and other clothing lines. And it's deer season, so that means cash back on rifles and shotguns from Browning and Winchester. Check them out online at tylerbrothers.net or visit the store in downtown Wagner.
Let's jump right back into the interview that we did earlier this week with Bill Marshall here on the Edisto TV podcast.
Just today, I posted to the Edisto Concerns site a link to an editorial that talks about how there are corporations, Nestle gets mentioned in this article, who are essentially pumping water for next to nothing and then commoditizing it and selling it. Will you riff a little bit on the idea that the resource belongs to the people, or does it? You mentioned the law doesn't affirm that.
I think there is certainly. I think our Supreme Court has ruled to some degree in saying, affirming that waters are not owned by a person, that they are in the public domain, and they should be managed in a way that meets the best interest of the public. So I guess commoditizing waters, I mean, I guess that's going to happen to some degree, but I don't know that we can get away with that, get away from that in our society, but I think there needs to be some common sense and public interest evaluation on all uses and a balancing of private use and public interest and when it comes to managing water. And that's the kind of thing you'd want sort of laid out in some general terms in a statute that, you know, affirms, you know, the public interest in water and the responsibility of the state to balance those interests between, you know, between public and private interest in use of the resource. So some of that just needs to be articulated. And I think folks who know law probably would say, yeah, it's important that as we go through time that for us to continue to affirm through policy statements, you know, what our values are and, you know, what we're trying to accomplish in these laws. But I don't think the current statute does that.
Yeah, I guess one of the questions that I got asked the other day talking to somebody about this was, how is pumping the public's water out of the river for private profit any different from taking my logging crew down to the state park and cutting some trees?
Yeah. Well, I think, again, I'm not the knowledgeable legal person, but, you know, this state had the riparian rights doctrine, and that was a common law. That's based in common law, as I understand it. It was this notion that anybody who has property along a river or stream has rights to water in that stream. They have the right to utilize water from that stream. It has to be a use that doesn't harm those folks downstream that rely upon the water as well. So it's a concept of sharing. You do have rights to the water, to utilize the water for private purposes, but you have community responsibilities as well. You're sharing a public resource. So, you know, obviously as we move forward in time, you got more and more users, and you know, in a more complicated society, it just begs for developing rules and procedures, information to and tools to better manage the resource and better equip us to fairly share a resource. And I just don't think the statute does that at all. So that's where we got to go is developing Austin's procedures that help us better share the resource in a way that protects the streams, protects the ecological functions of streams, provides for the needs of those riparian users. The tragedy of the commons is that it gets overly used and ultimately destroyed. Garrett Hardin, who developed this little parable about the tragedy of the commons, and I think his little parable was presented a pasture that was shared by a community of people, and early on there were just a few users and with a few animals, and they were able to share that resource equitably. And then as time went on, there was no manager for that pasture. Everybody just shared it, and then so the self-interest of individuals kind of grew and grew, and more people came. And so the lesson is you gotta have a steward or a manager to at least that's one scenario, is to find a steward to manage that shared resource or the commons. In that case, the pasture, and what we're talking about now is the water. And so you got to equip the manager to be able to require equitable sharing and a sustainable sharing, sustainable meaning you're not going to destroy the resource. So all that, I think, points to what we've been talking about, having a law that will allow use but not overuse and abuse of the shared commons, the commons being our rivers. The whole notion that we need more science, we need show me a problem and then we'll deal with it, I think that's all just short-sighted. You're not thinking in a reasonable way about your grandchildren or the future generations, or even what I would call sustainable economic development or quality of life for the generations that come. I think you've got to better manage these resources, and that's just going to require more rules. It really is. I mean, people hate to think about more regulations. They think it's the most terrible thing. It's going to stymie economic development. But it can be done in a way that's reasonable, and you minimize the burden. It just sort of sets limits, and there's got to be limits on a finite resource. And I think it's up to us as citizens to, speak to our vision for the future. It doesn't mean destroying our streams for the sake of, some kind of economic development vision, which is going to lead to deserts in the south in South Carolina. So it's a limited resource, and we gotta keep thinking about it, keep talking about it, and the pressures are going to be greater and greater, and the ability to make good decisions are going to. I don't know. Maybe some people might be playing a game to protect their rights, but I think we can make better decisions to conserve resources if we make them sooner rather than later, because interests just get locked in the further you go down the line, and we get to intractable kinds of conflicts rather than having more flexibility to make good decisions and set good policy. So sooner the better, from my view. And I think it can be done in a way that's not terribly burdensome and not a wet blanket on economic development.
All right. I think that was pretty much a call to action there at the end from Bill, that it needs to happen and sooner's better, right?
Yeah, and he touches on this idea of stewardship, right? So that means that, you know, it's not mine, but yet I'm, you know, called to take care of it. And so I'm not claiming it as my own river, but it is my duty to care for it and make sure it's there for my kids, my grandkids, and their grandkids.
Absolutely. And I think that the show notes are going to be replete with some resources where folks can begin to explore some of the issues like the tragedy of the commons idea that he mentioned. And so by all means, don't stop with what we have to tell you. Learn for yourselves. Go out, research, and if you find something of interest, let us know about it, because we're always looking for new things to put into the Edisto TV podcast. And that wraps it up for another edition of the Edisto TV podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
This is the Edisto TV podcast, produced by Edisto TV, connecting the Blackwater region.